Welcome back to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast. Today we have an episode with Golf Club Atlas founder Ran Morissette. But first, I'm very excited to announce that today's episode is powered by TD Ameritrade. Every stroke counts on the scorecard and every penny counts in the market. That's why TD Ameritrade is committed to straightforward pricing with no surprises, so you're free to swing with confidence. Visit tdameritrade.com/friedegg, member SBIC. Now, without further ado, here's Ran Morissette.
I miss a green, for example. I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
You're a big proponent of dogs on a golf course. Why is America lost its way and not allowed dogs for the most part on golf courses?
Well, Americans are good at always coming up with excuses, and they'll talk about the litigious nature of society, and if somebody's dog went over and barked and bit somebody, that the club would be liable and da-da-da-da-da. But, you know, they've done it in the UK for 150 years. It's just part of the game. It's part of the evolution of the game. And somehow they are able to figure out how to do it, and we're not. So I'm not going to come up with excuses for why it wouldn't work here. I just know that it works over there.
Yeah, it seems like it would make the game way more approachable. Also, I think about it, my wife isn't a big golfer, but she loves our dog. And if I go out and walk with the dog, she's exponentially more likely to come walk with me.
Exactly. I mean, you read the article I wrote in Golf Week. I mean, it just literally, my fondest memories are the five Morissettes and our dog Sandy going to the golf course. That trumps playing Cypress Point or Pine Valley or whatever. I feel like I'm 55, that the generations behind me are getting cheated of something, at least in this country. They're not in the UK, but they are here. And, you know, I lament that fact.
Besides dogs, what are kind of the, say, virtues of UK golf versus American golf you'd most like to see come to America?
Well, you know, in the UK, golf is a integral but relatively small part of your life. You should be able to go play 18 holes, have a match with your friend, maybe Stableford, in 3 hours or less. You have a pain at the end of the round, and you're back home all within 4 hours. In America, you might be looking at a 6-7-8 hour proposition. And it's just so much, you know, it's just infinitely more time consuming. And therefore, to a certain degree, it's just that much more selfish. I mean, it's a selfish pursuit. You're doing something that makes you happy. You're leaving your kids and your wife and your dogs at home. And so, you know, I like the way that the Brits do it. You know, if it takes several hours and you scoot right back home, you know, it's in proportion to its worth in your life, and you can get on and do all kinds of other things. So, you know, you can't walk a 7,000 yard course in 2 hours 45 like you can Swinley Forest. You know, I can play two rounds at Swinley Forest in the time that it takes to walk a quote unquote championship course in the United States. And so, you know, I'm just a huge fan of 6,000, 6,100, 6,200 yard courses. Par does not need to be reached, certainly 72. It can be 68, 67. You get your exercise in, you know, in a timely manner. And I think that that's, you know, the Brits approach it like that. I've never seen a Brit stand off to the side of a green and write his score down right after holing out. And, you know, through Golf Club Atlas, I've had a lot of guests here. And when I take them to Southern Pines Country Club, if somebody asks me after the first hole, what'd you get? I know that I've made a misjudgment in inviting that guy. And, of course, I'll always have some kind of witty retort for that. But, you know, the card and pencil mentality that McKenzie hated is alive and well here, but I don't see it in the UK.
It's the thing that drives me the most nuts is if I'm in the group behind a group that's in carts and, you know, they walk off the green and they put their putters in their bag and they get in the cart and then one will take off and one will be paused there for a second. And you know that they're writing down the scores for the hole.
Sad to say. I mean, if you see that unfolding, you're probably just playing the wrong golf course. You know, I mean, it's just not, you're not going to have kindred spirit golfers of the sort of golf that you and I like, you know, around you. And that's just too bad.
It's Southern Pines. That's one of the hidden gems of American golf.
It's, you know, it's a delight. I mean, I contend that it's on the best property in Moore County. Every hole rises or falls 20-30 feet. The green to tee walks are very short. I moved here in 2000, and Chris Bowie and I go out many evenings after work to play anywhere from 5 to 11 or 12 holes. And, you know, we're closing in on 20 years of having done that, and not once have I made the mile drive thinking, gee, I wish I was doing something else. I mean, I'm always keen to get to the golf course. And a lot of that's just because the land is so good. Yes, all the detail work, you know, the Ross detail work is missing. The greens have been modified. But nonetheless, the appeal of the land just shines through. They're only homes on two of the holes, and oftentimes we'll skip those two holes. And regardless of how I left the house, I will be coming home in a better mood. If I was in a great mood when I left the house, I'll be in an even better mood when I return. So my wife, Fritz, is always keen to shove me out the door and let me go get my hour fix.
It's funny. It was the middle of winter. We left for this trip, and one of the first nights, I was really stressed out. I'd been working all day, and I went out to a course and walked 9 and like 45, 50 minutes, came back, and my wife was like shocked. I was in a completely different state of mind. And it's just amazing how like the spiritual, like the release, like it's almost like meditation getting to go out and walk and play golf.
So you didn't race home and enter your scores into the gin handicap system and compute how many greens in regulation you had and how many putts.
I mean, I wasn't keeping my stats.
Exactly.
Yeah. I was just putting with a pin in. I was, I was hitting a second chip if I wanted to hit a second chip. But most importantly, I was just hitting the golf ball and walking.
That's what golf's for. And that just, that message somehow gets lost in this country. And again, people are free to turn the sport into anything that they want to. But for me, you know, it's pure relaxation. A friend of mine once said, well, you don't ever play for money. And I was like, I play for something, you know, much better than that. I mean, it's just, you know, bragging rights. And he didn't understand that.
I went through I was a competitive golfer for, you know, I still play some competitive golf, but I was playing for score, and I found myself, I got kind of, you know, lost in my way. But then when I started writing and reading more about architecture 3 years ago, then all of a sudden the enjoyment of golf like spiked. I cared so much less about what I was shooting, what I was scoring, and I was just enjoying walking and observing what was going on around me on the golf course. And it was just an enlightening moment. And I think that's the thing that people get lost with. It is the American mentality. It's always like striving. And what's ironic about it is at work, you're always striving to be better. You're trying to, you know, grow. And that's like, you know, that's where the stress comes from, right? It's like, why are we putting all this stress on when we're doing a leisure activity?
If I want stress, I'll stay at my desk. Is this meant to be a pure form of relaxation. And again, I don't know why, you know, let's say that you, instead of shooting 75, you wanted to shoot 73. Well, how much more short game time is that going to take for you to be away from your wife to try and lop those two shots off? And that's where it just becomes, you know, more and more and more of a selfish pursuit. And really, the only person who cares what you shoot is you. I mean, there's not a person in the world who cares what you shoot other than yourself. And, you know, all I can try and do is hope and pray to break 80. And, you know, if I do, you know, there's a sense of satisfaction. And if I don't, who cares? But one thing, you won't hear me talk about it. Yeah. 'Cause I know nobody cares.
Exactly. Nobody cares but yourself about what you're doing. Or the guy, maybe the guy that you're playing a match against cares. But
yeah. But then it's just match play and there's no score, right?
Yeah. I think that's like a big thing, is the match play component, like how much quicker things would play and how much differently course design would have been had match play been the predominant form of the game in the U.S. versus stroke play.
Well, you know, we've just profiled Somerset Hills and White Bear Yacht Club on Golf Club Atlas, and both of those end with 340, 350 yarders, both of which, you know, if you're in a tight match against a good player and you're pushing for three, it's really hard to achieve. And, you know, they're great match play holes. They don't fit into the American norm of the big, tough, you know, brutish, strong two-shotter to end the round. But again, in match play, you know, to me, it's much more interesting. Could you birdie the hole and win versus get a par and your opponent, you know, bogeys and has a mishap?
When you're evaluating, say, a golf course, and you just touched on two non-championship golf courses by certainly today's standards, fun golf courses to play versus a brutish championship course, how do you kind of look at them as two different types of golf?
No, I mean, it just, you know, the only thing that I know leaving a golf course is, do I want to come back? That's the only thing that matters to me. And if I do want to, you know, I never understand somebody who says, you know, I just loved it. I had the best time. You know, do you think you'll ever go back? No. I mean, you know, there, as you know, and as ease of travel has come about in the last two decades, there are now a lot of list chasers and people running around ticking boxes. I played here. I've played here. And, you know, if a guy has played a golf course one time, you know, he might have some surface remarks about it that you can pretty much read anywhere. I'm much more interested in the guy who's played it two, three, four, five times and really taken the time to start to get to know the course. But it all comes back to, you know, do you want to return? I'll never forget the first time I played Castle Stewart, I just felt like I missed, you know, I wasn't hitting the ball well. I was always out of position. I just felt like I was missing something. And I just knew that I was super keen to return. And so a few years ago, Fritz and I went up there in November. There were very few people. We stayed for 3 days, and everything just opened up before me. And it's just been one of my favorite courses ever since. But it only happens based on familiarity.
I feel the same way as, yeah, I was talking to somebody the other day about Old Town Club, and they're like, I'm surprised you're not hitting Old Town Club on this trip. And I was like, well, I talked to a guy at the club at Dunlop who suggested I come back in the fall. Plus, I didn't want to just squeeze in one day. Like, if I'm going to go there, I want to be there for
experience
at least two.
Properly. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's funny because, like, what you were just talking about, Castle Stewart, I played National Golf Links for the first time this year. And the first round, it was like I felt sensory overload. You know, I walked off the golf course and I was like, I've seen so much stuff that I was struggling to process, and then I got to go back again that week and play it again, and I picked up more, and then I went later in the year and you pick up more, and that time I played with older equipment, so I picked up even more. Like, you know, I'm playing with a Balada and all of a sudden this tee shot on 17 isn't just bash it up the left. It's like, oh my God, I'm seeing bunkers I hadn't seen before. And that's the thing, is with these great golf courses, you learn so much more and more and more every time around them. And it's almost it's unfair to even, that's something with a rating system. And I wanted to ask you is, like, how do you even cast judgment on a golf course one time around, especially with the, you know, the great ones?
You know, a lot of people, I remember a friend of mine, Ted Sturgis from Indianapolis, we went to see Chambers Bay, Tom Doak's course in Washington State, Tumble Creek, and the David McClay Kid course.
Gamble Sands.
And it was about a 5-day trip, and Ted asked me at the end, and then we saw Waverly and then the Cal Club. He goes, so, you know, how would you rank the five courses? And I said, Ted, you know, ask me in 5 weeks and I'll have had time to kind of mull it over. But I think that's a little bit part of the danger. And I'm not, I know I have a Twitter account, and people are tweeting at me, but I can't remember my password to ever respond. But I think that's a real danger. I personally would be very leery of making tweets leaving a golf course, because I just, you know, there's no rush. The world's not waiting for your opinion on a golf course. You might as well take the time to, you know, to kind of roll it around and think about it. You know, it's always been ironic to me. We expect our architects to live and die on a site and only do 2 or 3 courses max in a year. And then we blow in and out in 5 hours to render some, you know, judgment.
Yeah.
And, I mean, where's the fairness in that? It's just absurd.
People always are like, you don't write your review, like, you write about a golf course right away when it's freshest. And I'm like, well, I don't forget about it. I actually think more about it. And then you know what the stuff that sticks with you the most, too.
Right.
When you wait. So you started Golf Club Atlas in the late 90s. How did it come to be? And for anybody that's listening that's not gone to the site, it's essentially, I mean, something that's inspired me since I was a kid and read, and, you know, there's unbelievable troves of information about golf architecture on it.
Well, to be honest, I was bullied into starting it. Some friends of mine had some software and they wanted to prove to corporations that it worked. And they asked me if I had anything that they could load into it that would demonstrate its viability. And I said, no. And they came back and said, well, do you ever take pictures of anything? I said, apart from golf courses, no. And they said, well, you know, have you ever written about golf courses? And it turned out my brother and I wrote these little booklets, and we would send them to 20 or 25 people. I said, yeah, I enjoyed doing that. I said, well, why don't you do some course profiles? We can do this and this. And then the clincher was, they said you could have something called a discussion group. And this is in 1998. I'm like, well, what's that? And they said, well, you can post, and I'm living in Sydney, Australia. You can make a post, and people around the world can read it and then respond back. And at the time, I was going broke, calling people saying, I just played Royal Melbourne. I just played Kingston Heath. I just played New South Wales. And I'm getting these enormous phone bills. And I said, so wait. Essentially, I thought, well, if I did that, it would pay for these stupid phone calls of me bragging to people. Sure enough, we started to assemble things, and we went live in the summer of 1999.
With this all sudden ability for people to communicate, exchange ideas, you know, share information, how do you think golf architecture has changed with the founding of Golf Club Atlas?
Well, you know, a lot of clubs do kind of cloak and dagger stuff. I mean, I know growing up that the power and control on what direction a golf course was going to go resided with a few people. And now there's just so much more free flow of information, and it's available to anybody. And all you have to do is your due diligence. So there, in theory, there should be a lot more educated people on golf course architecture. You know, and in addition to the internet and websites and podcasts like yours, there was a real resurgence starting in the mid-90s just in printed literature. A lot of fine golf books. I know you're a huge fan of George Botto's book on C.B. McDonald. And just became an instant cornerstone book that could disseminate, you know, valuable information to every McDonald Rainer course out there. And you see places like Sleepy Hollow just latch on to it and run with it. So there's so much better information out there, and it's available to all the members. And to be honest, you know, what Golf Club Atlas has become since 2006-07 with the great implosion of new course construction has really been chronicling all the great restoration work, because there's been a paucity of new course construction. And you know, that's one thing that America has done better than the UK. Americans have taken greater, more records, and more detail has gone into restoration projects here than elsewhere around the golf globe.
Yeah, that's something that American golf's done better than. A rare thing for some. That's actually, I never thought about it that way.
And, you know, I can whine a lot and wish the sport was simpler here and wish it was more akin to the UK roots. But that thought occurred to me when I was in Edinburgh a few weeks ago, that is. And I asked several of the Scots I was with, and nobody really would take the other side of that argument. Mm-hmm. that they do better pure restoration work.
How long did you live in Australia?
7 years, 1993 to 2000.
How's the golf culture there different from, say, the UK and America?
You know, it's warmer. And so you'll see the folks with the socks pulled up to their knees and in short pants. And I don't think short pants are allowed even at some of the clubs in the UK. They have the same culture in terms of pull trolleys. I don't ever recall seeing a caddy in Australia other than at an event. If you're an able-bodied person in the UK or Australia, you're going to take a pull cart or you're going to carry your bag. I mean, you're not going to feel like a ponce and have some guy do it for you when you're perfectly capable. So, in a lot of ways, it's just a warm weather version of golf in the UK. The biggest difference that they do is that they pull their trolleys right across the greens rather than around the sides. And you see so much of the fringes in this country are oftentimes the worst presented part of the golf course because they get so much traffic. And Australia recognizes that. And they say the hardest surface on the golf course is the putting surface, and you'll do the least damage. So just go, drag your cart across.
It's funny. I as an American, you always walk around and put your bag on the fringe. And I was playing golf with Brian Palmer, who was the former superintendent at Shore Acres. And he's just putting his bag right on the green. And I'm like, well, if he's doing it, same idea. He's like, what, me resting this bag? And he has, a no stand carry bag, like a McKenzie bag, and him putting it down. I mean, that's less impact on the green than somebody walking.
It makes sense. Another thing in Australia, I remember, if you hit it to within your first putt to within 2 or 3 feet and assuming you're not in anybody's line, you are fully expected to hole out. Nobody wants to see you mark, clean the ball, step back, plumb bob, do this, do that. You know, there's a great sense of urgency to, you know, beat 4 hours and just play in a, you know, timely manner. Again, nobody has the patience to watch you grind over a 2.5 footer.
I don't have the patience to allow myself to grind over a 2 footer.
It just doesn't matter.
Yeah. Now let's take a few moments to talk about our sponsor. Today's episode is powered by TD Ameritrade. Whether on the course or in the market, it helps to have a second set of eyes to keep you on your game. That's why TD Ameritrade's trade desk is here to help gut check your strategies so you always feel confident teeing up a trade. Visit tdameritrade.com/friedegg to learn more about what their trade desk can do for you. Member SBIC. Now back to Rand Morissette. One of the new things that you added this year was to GCA is the 147 custodians of the game. I thought it was one of the best things I've read in a long time was the, you know, the preamble to the list of courses. Tell us a little bit about how you came up with that idea, why you decided to put it out now, and kind of the thought process behind what a true custodian of the game is.
Well, I have, you know, you and I were talking last night, you know, rankings and lists have taken on negative connotations lately. But I've always enjoyed puzzling over what resonated, what didn't, why do I like one course more than the other, blah, blah, blah. And so Tom Doak asked me to join the Golf Magazine panel in the mid-1990s when I was living in Australia, and I served on that panel. But I became frustrated by several things that were going on, and I didn't think that the direction really represented and espoused the kind of golf that I really enjoyed. So I resigned from that panel in March or April, knowing full well I'd already started to write the 147 custodians of the game. And one of the things that had prompted me was, you know, we write a lot of course profiles on Golf Club Atlas on courses that are, you know, whether they're nine-holers or 6,000, 62, 6,300 yards. And I've just received some of the nicest handwritten letters from people saying, thank you for being a voice of reason in the world. And so prompted by that, you know, it's one thing if you feel like you're the only person who enjoys that golf, and sometimes you would just kind of keep your opinion to yourself, but I think there's an enormous group of people who would enjoy playing, you know, three-hour round golf, and some of the things that we've talked about earlier on your show. And so I tried to give a voice to that, to what you know, would appeal. And then some of the things that, you know, that like in America, you know, some of the trappings of the game that don't actually lend any real value. And so to be honest, I am very proud, and I got a lot of help from three or four people who asked to remain anonymous, but I was really, really pleased with how it turned out, and I was pleased with the outcome because there were some people who were very upset that they didn't make it, which made me happy. And so, you know, it really reached far and wide. I mean, I'm a technological idiot, and I'm always amazed at, you know, Golf Club Atlas having been going for long enough, you know, we have a reach into, you know, all the corners of the world. And it was really pleasing. You know, a past captain of the RNA sent a glowing email. And to a guy like me who cares about the history of the sport, what can you say? I mean, it just meant a lot.
Yeah. So where, how's the list evolve? Is there, you know, plans for updating, changing as you go along?
The 100, so it's interesting. The 147 came about because there are 147 open championships that have been held. And there have been a few missteps along the way, like Carnoustie, where they lost control of the course 20 years ago. But by and large, it's been a testament to the game. So I decided to do 147. And I said, with each open championship, I will add another course to the list. And you know, in the process over the course of a year, I might revisit 10 or 15, you know, or so of those courses. And so there'll be some movement. Sean Arbol is I'm just a huge fan of Sean Arbol's work in the United Kingdom, profiling these country English courses, and working on a trip with him and my friend Joe Andreoli in the 1st of September to go see a lot of common ground courses up the west side of England. So I have a feeling that two or three of those will squeeze their way onto the list. And next it'll become 148 custodians, even though somebody said that the expression, the 147 custodians, is already wedged its way into the vernacular. And so you ought to keep it at that, even though the number will grow. And I think maybe that's the way I'll do it. And when it reaches 155 courses, you'll know that it's been going for 8 years. And so it'd be a nice process.
Yeah, and it gives people a reason to reread that again every year, which is, I think, important. Is that you're always good to reread stuff and like jog your memory of, oh, this is what is important.
Yeah, no, it's funny. You know, one of the comments came from an architect who just played Royal Portrush, and the several times that I've been there, it has had really wet, thick, heavy, rough lying on top of itself. And, you know, it's a course that's not heavily bunkered. And obviously, it's a very windy site. And then I just feared with the Open Championship coming there this year that it'd be even more narrow. And so that's an example of a course that didn't make it. And this architect was actually saying the playing conditions were wonderful and the rough wasn't impenetrable. So some of that just has to do with, you know, the weather and the time that you're there. And so, you know, probably is a course need to go revisit. But
how'd you get into golf courses in the start? I mean, you've been traveling a ton. You've seen everywhere. You've been heavily, you're one of the co-authors of the Confidential Guides with Tom Doak and Darius Oliver. And so how'd you, you know, kind of start this golf crazed life?
No, it's it's 100% due to Dad, who took a very relaxed approach, and he would go play nine holes every night after work, and he never put any pressure on us to go. And as soon as, you know, as soon as somebody doesn't want you to go, you want to go. So I mean, so you know, and so we would you know, we started off like that, and Dad worked at a regional investment firm in Richmond, Virginia, and there was a man named Harry Easterly who worked there too. And Mr. Easterly later became the president of the USGA and was the executive director of the USGA and was a member at St. Andrews and Muirfield and Augusta and Pine Valley. And Mr. Easterly took an interest in my dad and a father taking his three sons to play golf. And so in 1983, when I was 20 years old, we took our first trip to the UK and we played Dornoch, Muirfield, St. Andrews, and Turnberry. And, you know, if you didn't like golf then, you know, and you didn't, if that didn't pique your interest in golf architecture, then something was wrong. And I ended up working for the USGA for a couple of years in 1985, 86. You know, I started to see Fisher's Island, Shinnecock Hills, played Augusta with Mr. Easterly. So, you know, obviously an incredibly fortunate spoiled, rotten life. But it all resonated. And then, you know, comparing those courses, though, I was seeing some work going on to the Country Club of Virginia, where we remember, that just didn't resonate. It didn't mesh what I saw these great courses with what was going on with the local club. So you start pondering, wondering. And, you know, one of our first trips was to Pinehurst and Harbortown. It was a family vacation from Richmond. We stopped in Pinehurst and we went down to Harbortown. And, you know, Harbortown has some obvious wow moments and really cool features and really cool greens. And I still think that and Sand Hills are one of the two greatest courses, you know, in the modern game that changed the direction of the game. But nonetheless, we walked away thinking that Pinehurst was all that bit more special. And we just, and on the ride home from Hilton Head to Richmond, which was something like 8-9 hours, all we did was blabber about why we thought that. And so that's when I'm 14, 15, you know, poor mom's in the front. I'm sure she owned some earplugs that I never saw. But, you know, just trying to you know, comparing Harbortown with these, you know, Calabogie sound and high winds versus Pinehurst, which other than a couple of holes doesn't move up or down, you know, more than 10 or 15 feet. It really was an interesting mental exercise. So just, you know, from that first Pinehurst Harbortown trip to the UK trip to some exposure to the Northeast courses, including like Yale University, it was a recipe for falling in love with the study of golf architecture.
Yeah, I think that's Yale's one that kind of, I think, can show what how a person views the game. I was playing with a random guy yesterday, and he was like, "Oh, that towel, I have a Yale towel," and he couldn't see the whole towel. And he's like, that looks like that's a really wild course. Like, and he was, you know, in kind of a tone that was like, he didn't like it.
No.
And like the blind shots and everything, you could just tell like, oh, this is the type of, and I don't want that to sound the wrong way, but I said, "Oh yeah, that's an amazing place, huh?" And he's like, "Yeah, it's something." But you know, that place is like an adventure.
Yeah, I went up there when I joined the USGA in 85, and so I'm in Bernardsville, and Yale from Bernardsville, it was on a weekend. I went with Wes Seeley, who's the director of communication, and we saw Herbert Warren Wynn up on the patio wrapped up in a blanket, and that was awesome. But when we got back to the USGA, we said, "Yeah, we drove, you know, 2.5 hours to go see Yale." And the man's response was, "Why'd you go there? There's so many better conditioned courses in Connecticut." And, you know, and yes, there was goose droppings all over the third green and yada, 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 yada. And I came back just blown away by that golf. I mean, it was just eye-opening. And, you know, talking about inspiring and da-da-da-da-da. And then, you know, that guy's comment was just this bucket of cold water. And I just knew right away that he and I were coming at the sport from two different things, you know, two different angles. And again, not saying, you know, there's a right or a wrong, but, you know, I'll stick with my perspective.
That's something that I think about all the time, especially with Augusta National, is that Augusta National has this ability that it essentially shapes the way so many people look at the way at golf. But the thing that people take away from Augusta National seemingly always is the conditions and the beautiful flower beds, rather than like when it opened, it had 22 bunkers and it's got wide, you know, for the most part, really wide fairways and strategic bunkers, limited force carries, extremely playable. Like why do you think that's what the average American golfer takes away?
Yeah, you know, boy, Augusta, you know, for a lot of people, it kicks off their golf season. You know, if you live in Boston, you might not have hit a shot. And so it's just the the awakening of a season. So there's an automatic built-in euphoria. But I mean, from my perspective, last time I checked, Alistair McKenzie was viewed as a good architect. And the changes that have been made there in the last 20 years have really pivoted away from Bob Jones and Alistair McKenzie's original thoughts. And, when they built that course, the world's greatest courses, in the 30s, it was Pine Valley and it was Oakmont. And then, like you say, this course comes along with huge wide fairways, just a handful of bunkers, but a lot of really cool playing angles. And then systematically, you've seen them this century reduce the playing angles. And, I just find it appalling, the tree placement down the 11th hole. Maybe if they had if they'd put in trees on the left side of the fairway and push it over to the right. But, they just totally ruined all of the playing angles. Right now, you want to be, 10 yards into trees to have the best angle into the green. And so, its evolution is very regrettable. I'm personally shocked at how the rankings, all the magazines just give it a free pass. I mean, it really is a holy grail type place. And the poor work that goes on there just gets a pass. And I don't know, that's its clout.
I did a interesting article last year during the Masters. I looked at the scoring dispersion of holes from 1982 till now, and the 11th is like shocking. Is essentially they've traded birdies and double bogeys for pars and bogeys.
Yeah,
with the planting, like it's become such a one-dimensional hole, and it's taken away the thrills and the near thrills that bounce into the water, and all of a sudden a double bogey comes out of nowhere with a guy who thinks he can pull off a shot that's trying to, but like now it's just hit it in the fairway, and if you're not in a perfect spot, just bail out right.
Right. No, obviously the U.S. Open is now played in April, and that's really a shame because the Masters used to have its own voice, and it morphed into the U.S. Open. And, we already have a U.S. Open, so let's go back to that brand of golf. There are some rumblings that they are cognizant that they want to get back to how the course used to be. And, of course, those trees can be gone in a second on the 11th hole, just as an example. But the back tee on 7, 455-yard tee to that shallow green, it's just it's bad architecture, it's bad golf. You would think they would know better. I mean, to their credit, they don't even hardly use the tee anymore, but they ought to get rid of it.
Well, with the modern game and the modern driver, modern ball, I always reminds me of the McDonald quote with the Haskell ball, where he talked about how the Haskell ball has created, has made great holes indifferent and made many indifferent holes really great. And if the 7th, a 350-yard hole with a shallow green with a wide fairway would be one of the most compelling holes on the golf course with the modern game. It's like, where are the guys going to drive it up to? Are they going to try to drive it really close, or are they going to lay back? Or, all of a sudden, some guys might, on the right day with the right wind, be able to drive the green. And all of a sudden, that hole would be one of the most fun holes to watch on a golf course that's got a ton of, unbelievable holes to watch.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of courses where you automatically pull the driver every single time. And if they would play that hole from a 350 to 400 yard, I think you would see four or five different clubs pulled by different players. And in certain conditions, some people would probably try and drive it into the greenside bunker, but it'd be infinitely more interesting than having everybody hit driver and having a 8-iron in.
Obviously, I think we'd be in the same boat where we'd love to see Augusta National transform back to what it was. What are some of the projects that you've seen, say, over the course of GCA that have been the most inspirational in the sense of like transforming a golf course?
One would be Sleepy Hollow, where back when I worked at the USGA, we had a dinner there once, and nobody wanted to play the golf course. So it was just a having dinner in the Vanderbilt former estate, and now nobody would go to Sleepy Hollow and not beg to play the golf course. I mean, that's transformational. Los Angeles Country Club, you know, George Thomas is an absolute legend and hero. His work had been so mistreated. And at Los Angeles, you now see that he's one of the, you know, handful of greatest architects ever. You know, one restoration project that I think really flew under the radar, because it's a pretty quiet club, is the Country Club of Brooklyn. Again, Gil Hanse did it and just did, you know, top tier work. I was amazed to read some negative comments about the course, but that's such a cool old-fashioned course with, you know, the smallest greens this side of Pebble Beach, that it represents a very appealing throwback. And now with the work that's occurred there, it, you know, they fully embrace that. And again, you know, I want to go to a golf course that's different. I don't want to go to a golf course that I've seen 25 different versions of, and the Country Club, you know, in its old fashioned ways, you know, has its own voice.
I think that's an important part, is it's not about doing what the course down the street does. It's about doing what your course is, you know, and finding that unique feel, vibe, architecture, the funky stuff, getting that back and making yours not, you know, like the course down the street. And you that, make, you know, them look at it and say, I want to be like that golf course.
You know, you couldn't be more spot on. But in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s, it was the club down the road is planting trees, and so we should plant trees. And so the courses just became more and more the same. And, you know, what's the point in that?
Well, I mean, part of that, though, is that it tied with the trend of society. That was like the mass suburbanization, everybody moving to the suburbs, everybody's, you know, these housing developments that had the houses that looked exactly the same right down the row. And I think that's one of the things, golf architecture follows trends in society so much, and a sense of, I think we're starting to see this shift back to hand craftsmanship, and it falls in line with what's going on in the greater society, where people are more involved and more interested in experiences and more interested in, you know, buying lettuce that's locally farmed rather than the mass produced 50 cent lettuce. They want to have that. They want to know where it's from. And I think that's where we're starting to see that. I'd be interested. What do you think? You know, obviously restoration's been a huge part of golf course architecture the last, you know, 15, 20 years. What do you see as the next wave?
Well, you know, speaking of restorations, you know, you and I first met at the California Golf Club of San Francisco, which, you know, talking about a transformation. If you've, I had honestly never heard of that golf course. It came up in a few threads of Golf Club Atlas. But the, you know, the pictures that I saw, it didn't resonate, you know. And now, in my opinion, it's the finest course, you know, in the greater San Francisco area. And I, you know, talking about going from 0 to 10 in a rapid rate, I mean, that's a transformation that you just can't beat. So, you know, I'm not sure. You know, to answer your question, I'm not sure we need more golf courses. I'm not sure that golf is growing. Maybe it is with women. So I'm much more of a fan of taking care of what we have. I do not play poor, bad golf courses. I would rather not play than go play a poor course. And a lot of people, their exposure to golf is by playing in different courses, because their buddies just want to play whatever's the cheapest golf course. And there's no hook to get you involved. So, you know, if you said all we were going to do until 2050 is get our house in order and take care of all the courses that we have in the world already, I would be perfectly happy with that. Barring that, obviously what I'd like to see is, you know, some more 9-hole courses, more 6,000-yard courses come up, more courses that, you know, could be, and they have to be close to where people live. And the problem in America is the pricing of land can be prohibitive to then build something like that. But even as you and I discussed last night, even if it was a 5-hole golf course, I mean, something, but just make sure that it's of, you know, high quality. It makes people think, it makes people want to hit a bump and run shot. You have options. You can't have enough golf like that.
Yeah, I agree. It's the interesting aspect of how courses have gotten so long to fit for technology is just like when you're building a new course, do you build it to make it easy to walk for people playing the back tees or the middle tees? Either way, some class of golfer, because of the 7,000 yards, is going to have a bad walking experience where you're either walking back to tees or you have to walk forward all the time to tees, and you're going to have, you know, 50, 75 yard walks between greens and tees.
Yeah, I'm actually not even a fan of tees. I mean, I say prepare, give some prepared surfaces and let just people pick where they want to play from. And again, you can't have, you know, then you can't have a handicap if you're doing that and this and this and this. And you'll hear those arguments in this country, but you won't hear them in the UK.
Yeah, I was playing with some guys, and you know, it was a course I played a bunch of times, and it was really windy. And it was there's this great risk reward par 5. Like, it's an infinitely better hole if you have a chance to go for it in 2, and it's playing into a 25-mile-an-hour wind. So I say to the guys, like, let's go move up. We moved up to like the green tees, which were, you know, 120 yards shorter than the back tees that we were playing, just because I was like, you got to have a chance to go for this. It's a great golf hole, and if you don't have it, like, it's a much worse golf hole. So we move up. Everybody's having to hit like a long iron over, you know, over water, try, and you know, you either bail out or you go for it. And you know, everybody had, you could tell, had a great time. It's like, why can't you just play a tee based off of how you want to play a hole?
You'll get no argument from me. I mean, again, you start putting all these rules and regulations, you know, around a sport. You have to take a cart. You have to take a caddy. Well, really? Do you? I mean, why? Just, you know, like at the cow club, you can carry your bag, you can take a pull cart, you can take a caddy, or you can ride, you can do anything you want to. They just assume that the members have common enough sense to do the right thing.
I can't believe that pull carts are not allowed at a lot of clubs around the country.
Well, again, it gets back to the false perception that somehow they're tied to municipal courses only. And you go to Muirfield in Scotland and all you'll see are pull carts. I mean, the members never go hire a caddy. Mm-hmm. So it's just false. It's false perceptions that have been perpetuated. And
what bothers you more, mandatory carts or no pull carts allowed?
Mandatory carts is a no-go, so I'm just not going to be there. So that doesn't, I've had so many great experiences with caddies. It's not that conceptually that I have a problem with caddies, it's that you have to take one. But if you do go to a place and they say there are no pull carts, you know that they're trapped back in time, and that they're not, it's just bad decision making. So you're not likely to be with kindred spirits at a place like that.
All right, last question. You're a resident of the Greater Pinehurst area. You got 10 rounds. How are you splitting them?
Well, I will tell you, we're doing this interview on March the 1st, and this is the absolute best time of year to be here. Like, Pinehurst number 2 plays perfectly with its dormant Bermuda fairways, Dormy Club, Dormant Bermuda fairways. So this time of year, I would lean heavily on those two courses. You know, Mid Pines and Pine Needles, for reasons that I don't understand, they both overseed, and those courses become much slower and less fun. Mid Pines sparkles in August with their new Bermuda fairways. It can still be very bouncy, very firm. So I'm not trying to hedge on your answer. It depends on what time of year. You know, we've kind of got the big four and a half here. We've got Pinehurst number two, we've got Dormy, Mid Pines, Pine Needles, and then, you know, I'm a big fan of the Cradle. And then, you know, up the road, you've got Tobacco Road. And then just for a quiet afternoon hit, again, I've just never been disappointed by Southern Pines. But those are the courses that you have to see.
It's funny. When I plan my trip, and everybody's like, "Well, why are you coming now?" And I'm like, "Why am I coming now? When else would you go?" You listen to what Ross said about he was enamored with the way that played in the winter, and it was closed in the summer because in the winter the Bermuda didn't stick, and all of a sudden you could play ground game shots.
Well, yeah, they're very favorable rates here, and I've played number four Pinehurst number two four times between the first week in January and the last week of February. And the longest it took us was 4 hours and 15 minutes. One round was 3 hours and 50 minutes. And, you know, when the guests come in peak season, you know, the times are going to really swell beyond that. And that diminishes, you know, just some of the fun. But it's an absolute joy to live here right now. And I try to personally not travel very much so that I can take advantage of it this time of year.
Yeah. Well, I know you got a tight window here, so we appreciate the time. Everybody can read a lot of your writing on Golf Club Atlas. You're doing some contributing for Golf Week, and be sure to check out Golf Club Atlas if you haven't yet. It's really like a you know, if you're a golf course addict, it's where you can definitely get your fix on a regular basis.
Thanks for having me, and I look forward to seeing your Elks course up outside of Chicago this summer.
You got it. Got it. Let me know when you come.
You know I will.
Bring the dogs.
You're a good man.